fire. June. We're told that winter was fierce and spring was unusually profligate with bloom. Poppies have lingered and the fragrance of spiky yellow broom still fills the air. The house looks as if more sun soaked in during these months I've been gone. The finish that faux painters all over creation are trying to perfect, the seasons have managed admirably. Otherwise, all is the same, giving me the illusion that the months away were only a few days. A moment ago I was hacking weeds, and now I'm at it again, though frequently I stop. I am watching for the man with the flowers. A sprig of oleander, a handful of Queen Anne's lace and fennel bound with a stem, a full bouquet of dog roses, dandelion puffs, buttercups, and lavender bells. Every day I look to see what he has propped up in the shrine at the bottom of the driveway. When I first saw the flowers, I thought the donor was a woman. Then one day I saw a man walking down the road from Cortona. He was slow and dignified. I heard the crunch of his steps on the road stop for a moment. Later I found a fresh clump of purple sweet peas in the shrine, and yesterday's wild asters thrown down into the pile of other wilting and dead bundles. Now I wait for him. He examines what wildflowers the roadside and fields offer, leans to pick what he fancies. He varies his selection, bringing new blooms as they spring up. I'm up on a high terrace, hacking ivy off stone walls and chopping off dry limbs of neglected trees. The grass brushes my knees. When I stop just to look, the pilgrim is approaching. He pauses in the road and stares up at me. I wave, but he does not wave back, just blankly stares as though I, a foreigner, am a creature unaware of being looked at, a zoo animal. The shrine is the first thing you see when you come to the house. Cut into a curved stone wall, it's an ordinary one in these parts, a porcelain Mary on a blue background, in the Della Robbia style, centered in an arch. He's an old man, this wayfarer, with his coat draped over his shoulders, and his slow, contemplative walk down the road. Once I passed him in the town park, and he gravely said, "Buongiorno," but only after I spoke first. His eyes are cloudy and remote, a stony blue. I begin to get the idea that he is possibly an angel, since his coat always hangs around his shoulders, and since he seems to be invisible to everyone but me. I remember the dream I had the first night I spent here. I would discover 100 angels, one by one. This angel, though, has a body. He wipes his forehead with his handkerchief. Perhaps he was born in this house, or he loves someone here. Or the pointed cypresses that line this road, each one commemorating a local boy who died in World War I. So many from such a small town remind him of friends. His mother was a great beauty and stepped into carriages on this spot. Or his father was tight as a whip and forbade him to enter the house ever again. He thanks Jesus daily for saving his daughter from the perils of surgeons in Parma. Or perhaps this is just the far point of his daily walk, a pleasant habit, a tribute to the walk god. Whatever, I hesitate to wipe the road dust from Mary's face or shine the blue to gloss with a cloth, even to disturb the mound of stiff bouquets piled on the ground, still intact. From this terrace I can't see or hear the workers' chaos going on below. I see our olive trees, some stunted or dead from the famous freeze of 1985, others flourishing, flashing silver and green. I count three figs with their large, improbable leaves, visualizing yellow lilies beneath them. I can rest here, marveling over the hummocky hills, cypress-lined road, cerulean skies with big Baroque clouds that look as if cherubs could peer from behind them, distant stone houses barely brushed in, neat terraces of olive and grape. That I have acquired a shrine amazes me. What amazes me more is that I have taken on the ritual of the man with the flowers. I lay the clippers down in the grass. He approaches slowly, the bouquet almost behind him. When he is at the shrine, I never watch. Later, I will walk down the terrace down the driveway to see what he left. The brilliant yellow broom called Genestra and red poppies, lavender and wheat. I always touch his blade of weed, tying them together. Ed is two levels up, chopping rampaging ivy out of a black locust tree. At every ominous crack or snap, I expect to see him careening down the terraces. I pull at tough runners in a stone wall. Ivy kills. It causes stone walls to fall. Some of the trunks are as big as my ankle. As I move along this wall, I almost disappear into a hole. I call Ed to come down. Look, is this a well? But how could there be a well in a wall? He scrambles down to the terrace just above me and leans over to look. Where he is, both ivy and blackberries are unnaturally dense. It looks like an opening up here. He turns on the weed machine then, but when blackberries keep choking the filaments, he resorts to the Grim Reaper scythe. Slowly, he uncovers a chute lined with stones. The immense back stone curves down like a playground slide and disappears underground, opening in the wall I'm trimming. We look at the terrace above him, nothing. But two terraces up, in a line from here, we see another unnaturally large blackberry clump. Perhaps we just have water and wells on the brain. A few days before, when we arrived for the summer, we were greeted by trucks and cars along the road and a pile of dirt in the driveway. The new well, drilled by a friend of Signor Martini, was almost finished. This must be the deepest well in Christendom. They had hit water quickly, but Signor Martini told them to keep going, that we never wanted to run out of water again. Without our even thinking of it, they have moved the water heater from the older bathroom to the kitchen, so we'll have hot water in our improvised kitchen this summer. I'm touched that Signor Martini has had the house cleaned and has planted marigolds and petunias around the palm trees. A touch of civilization in the overgrown yard. How's your business, I ask? Sell many houses to unsuspecting foreigners? Non c'è male, not bad. He beckons for us to follow. At the old well, he pulls a weight out of his pocket and plunks it down the opening. Immediately, we hear it hit water. He laughs. Pieno, tutto pieno. Over the winter, the old well has completely filled. I read in a local history book that Torrione, the area of Cortona where Bronasole sits, is a watershed. On one side of us, water runs to the Val di Chiana. On the other, water runs down to the valley of the Tiber. We already are intrigued by the underground cistern near the driveway. Shining a light down the round opening, we've contemplated the stone arch, tall enough to stand under, and a deep pool our longest stick can't measure. I remember a Nancy Drew I liked at 9, the mystery in the old well, though I don't recall the story. Medici escape routes seem more dramatic. Looking down into the cistern taps my first memory of historical Italy. Mrs. Bailey, my 6th grade teacher, drawing the soaring arches of a Roman aqueduct on the board, explaining how ingenious the ancient Romans were with water. The Aquae Marcia was 62 miles long. That's 2/3 of the way from Fitzgerald, Georgia to Macon, she pointed out. And some of the arches still exist from the year 140. I remember trying to grasp the year 140. Meanwhile, overlapping the arches onto the Ben Hill County Highway north. The cistern opening seems to disappear into a tunnel. We stare into the dark, wondering how large the scorpions and vipers are, just out of sight. Above the cistern, a bocca, a mouth, opens in the stone wall, as though water should pour into the cistern. As we strip the ivy's thick roots and webs off the stone walls, we realize that the chute we are uncovering must be connected to the opening above the cistern. Over the next few days, we discover 4 stone chutes running downhill, from terrace to terrace, and ending at a large square mouth that goes underground for about 25 feet, then reappears on the lowest terrace just above the cistern. The The backs of all the chutes have the big single stone curved for the water to flow down. When the channels are cleaned out, water will cascade into the cistern after rains. Fortunately, we didn't stumble into these chutes last year as we blithely meandered the terraces, admiring wildflowers. On the third level terrace wall, a rusted pipe crumbles off as we hack at thorny blackberries. At the base, we discover a flat stone. As we shovel off dirt and pour on water, it grows. Something gigantic is buried here. Slowly, we uncover the roughly carved stone sink that once was used in the kitchen before the so-called improved concrete sink was installed. I'm afraid it's broken, but we scrub mud away, wedge it out of its hole with a pick, and find intact the single stone 4 feet long, about 18 inches wide and 8 inches thick, with a shallow indented basin for washing and with drainage ridges chipped out on either side. The corner drain is clogged with roots. We've been sorry our house didn't have this original and very characteristic object. Many old houses have similar sinks in place, draining directly out the kitchen wall and off a scallop-shaped stone shelf into the yard. I would like to wash my glasses in this prototype sink. We'll put it against the house outside, under the trees, a place to keep ice and wine for parties and to wash up after gardening. It has been used to scrub enough crusty pots in its day. From now on, an honored place to fill a glass, a place for a pitcher of roses on the stone. It will be returning to good use after many years buried in dirt. After a few more minutes of chopping, I'm about 12 feet away from the stone sink when two rusted hooks appear under the leaves. Beneath them, again, we see a glimpse of flat stone. Ed shovels off a mound of dirt. In the middle, he hits a latch, around which is twisted a rusty coil of wire. We make out a circular opening. He has to angle the shovel in the crack to pry up the long covered stone lid. It is late afternoon, just after a thunderstorm, when the light turns that luminous gold I wish I could bottle and keep. Off comes the lid, and the light that falls down strikes clear water in a wide natural cleft of white stone. We can see another undulation of the stone, too, where the water becomes aqua. We lie on our stomachs on the ground, taking turns sticking our heads and the flashlight down the hole. On the bottom, we see a big can on its side and easily read the magnified green words, Olio d'oliva. Not exactly like finding a Roman torso or amphora with dancing satyrs. A rusty pipe leans against the back of the white stone, and we notice that it emerges just below the two hooks. Someone stopped it up with a wine cork. It now seems obvious that the hooks once secured a hand pump, and that this is a lost natural spring hidden for years. How long? I read about a man nearby who went in his backyard on Christmas Eve to pick lettuce for dinner and caved into an Etruscan tomb with elaborate sarcophagi. Is this simply a fortuitous opening in rock that supplied water for farming? This must have been covered when the second well nearby was dug. Now we have a third well. We're the latest layer of water seekers. Our technology, the high whining drills able to pierce any rock, long removed from that of the discoverer of this secret opening in the earth. We call Signor Martini to come see this miraculous finding. Hands in pockets, he doesn't even lean over.
Bo, he says.
Bo is an all-purpose word, sort of well, oh, who knows, or dismissal. Then he waves a hand over it. Aqua. He regards our fascination with abandoned houses and such things as ancient wells as further evidence that we are like children and must be humored in our whimsies. The elaborate underground system makes us understand precisely how precious water is in the country. When it flows, you figure out ways to save it. When it is plentiful as now, you must respect it. St. Francis of Assisi must have known this. In his poem, The Canticle of the Creatures, he wrote, "Be praised, O Lord, for Sister Water, the witch, is so useful, humble, precious, and chaste. We convert instantly to short showers, to turning off the water quickly when washing dishes and brushing our teeth. Do not waste a drop. We'd noticed vaguely when we bought the house that a stone wall perpendicular to the front had tumbled down in a few places. Weed sumac and fig sprouted along the fallen rocks. Now we realized that a 120-foot-long wall of immense stone would have to be rebuilt. During those few weeks here last summer after buying the house, Ed started to take down parts of the wall adjacent to the tumbled sections. He thought stone building sounded gratifying, finding just the right stone to slide into place, tapping it in with the mallet, scoring stone surfaces, hitting them precisely to direct the split. The ancient craft is appealing. So is the good hard labor. An alarming pile of stones grew daily, as did his muscles. He became a little obsessed. He bought thick leather gloves. Big rocks went in one line, small ones in another, and flat ones in another. Like all the terrace walls on the property, this was drywall, with a depth of more than a yard, nicely fitted and stacked stones in front, neat as a jigsaw, with smaller ones behind. The wall leaned backward to counteract the natural downward heave of the hillside. These walls are actually structural. Only with braced terraces is a hillside like ours an olive farm or vineyard. On one terrace where the stones fell, a large almond tree also toppled. When we had to leave, about 30 feet of the wall lay in orderly piles. Over the winter we read Building with Stone by Charles McRaven. Ideas such as sealing out moisture and foundations and frost lines started to crop up. The height of the remaining wall was not the actual height the rebuilt wall would have to be to support the broad terrace leading up to the house. Besides being 120 feet long, the wall must be 15 feet high, buttressed from behind. As we read about packed fill, thrust, balance, and all the ways the earth shifts when it freezes, we begin to think we had the Great Wall of China on our hands. We were absolutely right. We've just had several experienced muratori, or masons, out to view the remains. This job is a monster. Restoration work inside seems dwarfed beside this project. Still, Ed envisions himself apprentice to a rugged man in a cap, a stone artist. Santa Madonna, molto lavoro. Much work, each muratore exclaims in turn. Molto, troppo, too much. We learn that Cortona recently adopted codes for walls such as this one because we're in an earthquake zone. Reinforced concrete will be required. We are not prepared to mix concrete. We have 5 acres of blackberry and sumac jungle to deal with, trees that need pruning, not to mention the house. The wall estimates are astronomical. Few even want to tackle the job. This is how in Tuscany we build the Great Wall of Poland. Signor Martini sends a couple of his friends by. I forewarn him that we are interested in getting the work done immediately, and that we want a price for fratelli, brothers, not for stranieri, foreigners. We are recovering from the new well and still awaiting permits, so the major housework can begin. His first friend says 60 days of labor. For his price, we could buy a small steamer and motor around Greece. The second friend, Alfiero, gives a surprisingly reasonable estimate, plus has the terrific idea that another wall should run along the row of linden trees on an adjacent terrace. When you don't speak a language well, many of your cues for judging people are missing. We both think he is fey, an odd quality for a mason, but Martini says he is bravo, so we sign a contract. Our geometra doesn't know him and cautions us that if he's available, he probably is not good. This kind of reasoning doesn't sink in with us. The schedule calls for work to begin the following Monday. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday pass. Then a load of sand arrives. Finally, at the end of the week, Alfiero appears with a boy of 14 and, to our surprise, three big Polish men. They set to work, and by sundown, amazingly, the long wall is down. We watch all day. The Poles lift 100-pound stones as though they were watermelons. Alfiero speaks not a word of Polish, and they speak about 5 words of Italian. Fortunately, the language of manual labor is easy to act out. Via, via. Alfiero waves at the stones, and they have at them. The next day, they excavate dirt. Alfiero exits to go to other jobs. The boy, Alessandro, purely pouts. Alfiero is his stepfather and evidently is trying to teach the boy about work. He looks like a little Medici prince, petulant and bored, as he stands around listlessly kicking stones with the toe of his tennis shoe. The Poles ignore him. From 7 until 12, they don't stop. At noon, they drive off in their Polski Fiat, returning at 3 for 5 more solid hours of labor. The Italians, who have been guest workers at many times and in many countries, are thrown by the phenomenon happening in their own country. During the second summer at Bramasole, the newspapers are tolerant to indignant about Albanians literally washing up on the shores of southern Italy. Living in San Francisco, a city where immigrants arrive daily, we cannot get excited about their problem. Americans in cities have realized that migrations are on the increase, that the whole demographic tapestry is being rewoven on a vast scale in the late 20th century. Europe is having a harder time coming to grips with this fact. We have our own poor, they tell us incredulously. Yes, we say, we do too. Italy is amazingly homogeneous. It is rare to see a black or Asian face in Tuscany. Recently, Eastern Europeans, finding the German workforce at last full of people like themselves, began arriving in this prosperous part of northern Italy. Now we understand Alfiero's estimate for the work. Instead of paying the normal Italian 25 to 30,000 lira per hour, he is able to pay 9,000. He assures us they are legal workers and are covered by his insurance. The Poles are pleased with the hourly wage. At home, before the factory went kaput, they barely earn that much in a day. Ed grew up in a Polish-American Catholic community in Minnesota. His parents were born of Polish immigrants and grew up speaking Polish on farms on the Wisconsin-Minnesota border. Of course, Ed knows no Polish. His parents wanted the children to be all American. The 3 words he tried out with the Poles, they couldn't understand. But these men he can understand seem very familiar. He's used to names like Orachowski, Cichosz, Borakowski. Passing in the yard, we nod and smile. Soon Alfiero becomes a problem. He lights like a butterfly on one project after another, starting something, doing a sloppy job, then taking off. What neither Signor Martini nor Alfiero realizes is that the Poles let us know when something is not right. Signora, says Christoph, who wants us to call him Cristoforo. Italia cemento. He crumbles 2 dry cement between his fingers, then Polonia cemento. He kicks a rock-hard section of the retaining wall. This has become a nationalistic issue. Alfiero, poco cemento. He puts his fingers to his lips. I thank him. Alfiero is using 2 little cement in his mixture. Don't tell. They begin to roll their eyes as a signal or, after Alfiero departs, which usually is early in the day, to show us problems. Everything Alfiero touches seems bad, but we have a contract. They work for him, and we are stuck with him. However, without him, we would not have met the Poles. They sing while they heave stone, and their voices begin to sound like the way the work of the world should sound. Sometimes Cristoforo sings in a falsetto, a strangely moving song, especially coming from his big brown body. They never skimp on a minute's work, even though their boss is gone all the time. On days when their supplies are gone because Alfiero forgets to reorder, he capriciously tells them not to work. We hire them to clear the terraces of weeds. Finally, we have them sanding all the inside shutters. They seem to know how to do everything and work about twice as fast as anyone I've ever seen. At the end of the day, they strip and rinse off with the hose, dress in clean clothes. Then we have a beer. Don Fabio, a local priest, lets them live in a back room of the church. For about $5 apiece, he feeds all three of them 3 meals a day. They work 6 days a week. The priest doesn't allow them to work on Sunday, exchanging all the lira they make into dollars and stashing it away to take home for their wives and children. We pick up Polish words, jutro, tomorrow, stopa, foot, brudny, dirty. Also something that sounds like grubia, which was their name for Signor Martini's sloping stomach. They learned beautiful and idiot, and quite a few Italian words, mostly infinitives. Despite Alfiero, the wall is strong and beautiful. A curving flight of stairs with a flat side for pots of flowers connects the first two terraces. The well and cistern have stone walls around them. From below, the wall looks immense. It's hard to get used to, since we like the tumbled look, too. Like the other walls, soon it will have tiny plants growing in the cracks. Because the stone is old, it already looks natural in the landscape, if a bit tall. The poles take us down to the wall and dig the dirt away from a few feet of the foundation. In large letters, they've written Polonia in the concrete. The well and wall feel like significant accomplishments. The house, however, still is untouched. Until the main jobs are finished, there's little to do. No point in painting when the walls will have to be open for the heating pipes. Ed and I work on the terraces or travel around selecting bathroom tile, fixtures, hardware, paint. We look, too, for the old thin bricks for the new kitchen's floor. One day we buy 2 armchairs at a local furniture store. By the time they're delivered, we realize they're awkward and the dark paisley fabric rather weird, but we find them sumptuously comfortable after sitting upright in the garden chairs for weeks. On rainy nights, we pull them face to face with a cloth-covered crate between them, our dining table with a candle, jam jar with wildflowers, and a feast of pasta with eggplant, tomatoes, and basil. On cool nights, we build a twig fire for a few minutes, just to take the damp chill off the room. Unlike last summer, this July is rainy. Impressive storms hit frequently. Often they seem to arrive at night. One night when rain starts to clatter in the palm trees, I go to the window and lean out, then quickly step back. Bolts spear into the ground, jagged like cartoon drawings of lightning, 4, 5, 6 at once, surrounding the house. Thunderheads swarm over the hills, and the quiet rolling suddenly changes its tune and starts to explode so close it feels like my own backbone snapping. The house shakes. This is serious. The lights go out. We fasten the windows inside, and still the wind whips rain through cracks we didn't know were there. Spooky wind sucks in and out of the chimney. Wild night. Rain lashes the house, and the 2 silly palms give and give in the wind. I smell ozone. I'm certain the house has been struck. This storm has selected our house. It won't move on. We're the center and maybe washed downhill to Lake Trasimeno. Which would you prefer, I ask, landslide or direct hit by lightning? We get under the covers like 10-year-olds shouting stop and no each time the sky lights up. Thunder enters the walls and rearranges the stones. When the big storm starts passing to the north, the black sky is left washed clean for stars. Ed opens the window and the breeze sends in pine scent from blown down limbs and scattered needles. The electricity still is out. As we sit propped up on pillows, waiting for our hearts to slow down, we hear something at the window. A small owl has landed on the sill. Its head swivels back and forth. Perhaps its perch was blown down, or it is disoriented by the storm. When the moon breaks through the clouds, we can see the owl staring inside at us. We don't move. I'm praying, please don't come into the room. I am deathly afraid of birds, a holdover phobia from childhood, and yet I am entranced by the small owl. Owls seem always to be more than themselves, totemic in America, symbolic at least, and here, mythological as well. I think of Minerva's owl, but really it's just a small creature that belongs to this hill. We have seen its larger forebears several times at evening. Neither of us speaks. Since it stays, we finally fall asleep and wake in the morning to see that it has flown. At the window, only the 6:15 light. Raked gull angling across the valley, suffusing the air briefly before the sun clears the hills and lifts into the absolved clear day. Whir of the sun. The house, only 2 kilometers from town, feels like a deep country place. We can't see any neighbors, although we hear the man way above us calling, "Vieni qua," come here, to his dog. The summer sun hits like a religious conviction. I can tell time by where the sun strikes the house, as though it were a gigantic sundial. At 5:30, the first rays smack the patio door, rooting us out of bed and giving us the pleasure of dawn. At 9, a slab of sunlight falls into my study from the side window, my favorite window in the house, for its framed view over the cypresses, the groves in the valley, and out into the Apennines. By 10, the sun swings high over the front of the house and stays there until 4, when a cut of shadow across the lawn signals that the sun is heading toward the other side of the mountain. If we walk to town that way in late afternoon, we see a prolonged, grandiose sunset over the Val di Chiana, lingering until it finally just dissolves, leaving enough streaked gold and saffron behind to light a way home until 9:30, when indigo dark sets in. On moonless nights, it is as black as inside an egg. Ed has gone back to Minnesota for his parents' 50th wedding anniversary. A shutter bangs. Otherwise, the silence reverberates so strongly that I think I can hear my own blood circulating. If only Sister, my black long-haired cat, were here. She is truly a good companion for solitude, but it's far too hot for her to sleep against my feet as she likes to do. She would have to stay on a pillow at the foot of the bed. I sleep like one newly born and in the morning have coffee on the patio, walk to town for groceries, work on the land, come in for water, and it's only 10 o'clock. Hours go by without the need to speak. A French woman and her English husband walk up the driveway and introduce themselves as neighbors. They've heard Americans bought the place and are curious to meet those mad enough to take on this ordeal of restoration. They invite me to lunch the next day. Since both are writers and are restoring their small farmhouse, we fall into instant camaraderie. Should they have the staircase here or there, and what to do with this tiny room? Would a bedroom in the animal stall downstairs be too dark? They invite me to dinner the next night and introduce me to 2 other foreign writers, French and Asian American. By the time Ed returns in a week, we're invited to the house of these writers. The table is set under a shady grape arbor, cold salads, cold wine, fruit, a grand cheese souffle somehow steamed on top of the stove. We're introduced to the other guests, novelists, journalists, translators, a nonfiction writer, all older expatriates who've settled in these hills and restored properties. To live wholly in another country fascinates me. I'm curious how the trip or assignment to Italy turned into a lifetime for each of them, and I ask Fenella, the international journalist on my right, about this. "You can't imagine what Rome was in the 50s, she says. Magic. I simply fell in love like you fall in love with a person, and schemed to find a way to stay there. It wasn't easy. I got on as a stringer for Reuters. Look at the old movies and you'll see there were almost no cars. This was not long after the war and Italy was devastated, but the life. It was unbelievably cheap, too. Of course, we didn't have much money, but we lived in enormous apartments in grand palazzi for nothing. Every time I went back to America, I just couldn't wait to get back. It wasn't a rejection. Or maybe it was. Anyway, I've never wanted to be anywhere else. We feel the same way, I say, and then realize that's not really the truth. I succumb totally to the magic of this place, but I know the appeal to me is partly the balance it restores to my life in America. I'm not about to leave there, even if I could. I try to amend what I've said. My job at home is hard, but I really love it. I'm pushed by it, but spending time here lets me escape the craziness and violence and just downright surreal aspects of America. Still, I sense that I can best develop my thinking there. It's my culture, my rough edge, and my past. I'm not sure I've explained myself well. She raises her glass to me. Esatto, my daughter feels the same. You didn't come along in time to know Rome back then. It's terrible now, but then it was irresistible. I suddenly realize they're in double exile, from the United States and from Rome. Max joins in. He had to go to Rome last week and the traffic was horrendous. Then the gypsies accosted him, as if he were a tourist, pressing their cardboard against him in an effort to distract him while they tried to pick his pocket. Long ago I learned to put the evil eye on them, he tells Ed and me. They scatter then. They all agree Italy is not what it used to be. What is? All my adult life I've heard how Silicon Valley used to be all orchards, how Atlanta used to be genteel, how publishing used to be run by gentlemen, how houses used to cost what a car costs now. All true, but what can you do but live now? One guest is a writer I've long admired. She moved here about 20 years ago, after living for years in the post-war wild south of Italy and then in Rome. I knew she lived here and even had been given her telephone number by a mutual acquaintance in Georgia where she now spends a part of every year. Cold calls always have been hard for me to make, and I am a little awed by the woman who wrote in luminous, austere prose about the dark, raucous, convoluted lives of women down in ravaged Basilicata. Elizabeth is across the table and down from me. I see her cover her glass with her hand as Max starts to pour wine. You know I never drink wine at lunch. Ah, the austerity. She wears a blue cotton shirt with some vaguely religious-looking medallion around her neck. She has a dead-level blue gaze, fair skin, and a voice I think has a touch of my own accent. I lean forward and venture, is that a trace of a southern accent? I certainly hope not, she snaps. Do I see a hint of a smile? And quickly turns back to the famous translator beside her. I look down into my salad. The gathering is mellowing. Several empty wine bottles stand on a side table. The intense sun is now caught in the limbs of a chestnut. Ed and I join in where we can, but this is a lively group of old friends with years of shared experiences. Fenella talks about her research trips to Bulgaria and Russia. Her husband, Peter, tells a story about bringing a gray parrot in his coat pocket when he came back from an assignment in Africa. Cynthia talks about a family dispute over her famous mother's notebooks. Elizabeth looks bemused. As the party breaks up, she says, you were supposed to call me. I've tried to get your number, but there's no listing. Irby, a friend of my sister's, told me you've bought a house here. In fact, I met your sister at a dinner in Rome, Georgia, that is. I make excuses about the confusions of the house, then impulsively ask her to dinner on Sunday. Impulsively because we don't have any furniture, dishes, linen, only the rudimentary kitchen with a few pots and plates. I pick up a linen cloth at the market to cover the ramshackle table left behind in the house, arrange wildflowers in a jar, and place it in a flower pot. Plan dinner carefully, but keep it simple, ravioli with sage and butter, sautéed chicken and prosciutto rolls, fresh vegetables and fruit. As Elizabeth arrives, Ed is moving the table out to the terrace. The entire top and one leg fall off, either an icebreaker or a disaster. She helps us piece the table together, and Ed pounds in a few nails. Covered and set, it looks quite nice. We tour the big empty house and begin to talk drain pipes, wells, chimneys, whitewash. She completely restored a noble Casa Colonica when she moved here. Quickly, it becomes clear that she knows everything about Italy. Ed and I begin what is to become the 10,000 questions. Where do you get your water tested? How long was a Roman mile? Who's the best butcher? Can you buy old roof tiles? Is it better to apply for residency? She has been an intense observer of Italy since 1954 and knows an astonishing amount about the history, language, politics, as well as the telephone numbers of good plumbers, the name of a woman who prepares gnocchi with the lightest touch north of Rome. Long dinner under the moon, hoping the table won't keel over. Suddenly, we have a friend. In town, Ed and I are beginning to feel more at home. We try to buy everything right in the local shops. Hardware, electrical transformers, contact lens cleaner, mosquito candles, film. We do not patronize the cheaper supermarket in Camuccia. We go from the bread store to the fruit and vegetable shop to the butcher, loading everything into our blue canvas shopping bags. Maria Rita starts to go in back of her shop and bring out the just-picked lettuces, the choice fruit. "Oh, pay me tomorrow," she says, "if we only have large bills." In the post office, our letters are affixed with several stamps by the postmistress, then individually hand-canceled with vengeance. Whack, whack, buongiorno, signori. At the crowded little grocery store, I count 37 kinds of dried pasta, and on the counter, fresh gnocchi, peachy, thick pasta in long strands, fettuccine, and two kinds of ravioli. By now, they know what kind of bread we want, that we want the buffalo milk mozzarella, not the normale, regular cow's milk kind. We buy another bed for my daughter's upcoming visit. At the Saturday market, a very young woman with tousled black curls sells old linens. For Ashley's bed, I find a heavy linen sheet with crocheted edges and big square pillowcases of lace and embroidery. Surely these accompanied a bride to her marriage. The condition is so good I wonder if she ever took them from the trunk. They have dusty lines where they've been folded, so I soak them in warm suds in the hip bath, then hang them out to dry in the midday sun, a strong, natural bleach that turns them back to white. Elizabeth has decided to sell her house and rent the former priest's wing attached to a 13th-century church called Santa Maria del Bagno, St. Mary of the Baths. Although she won't move until winter, she begins to sort her belongings. Perhaps out of memory of that first dinner, she gives us an iron outdoor table and four curly chairs. We also are the recipients of several bookcases and a couple of shopping bags full of books. The 14th-century hermits who lived on this mountain still might approve of our white rooms so far. Beds, books, bookcases, a few chairs, a primitive table. Big willow baskets hold our clothes. We're expecting the permits soon. Meanwhile, the main project we hope to finish before we go home at the end of August is the sandblasting of the beams. Each room has two or three large beams and 25 or 30 small ones. A big job. Ferragosto, August 15th, is not just a holiday for the Virgin. It is a signal for work to cease and desist all over Italy, both before and after that day. We underestimated the total effect of this holiday. When we began calling for a sandblaster, we found only one who would think of taking the job in August. He was to arrive on the 1st, the job to last 3 days. On the 2nd, we began to call, and have been calling ever since. A woman who sounds very old shouts back that he is on Vicenza al Mare, he's over on the coast, walking those sandy beaches instead of sandblasting our sticky beams. We wait, hoping he will appear. Although we can't paint until after the central heating is installed, we begin to scrub down the walls in preparation. On Saturdays and odd days when they're not working elsewhere, the Poles come over to help us. The flaky whitewash brushes off on our clothes if we rub against it. As they clean the walls with wet cloths and sponges, they uncover the earlier paints, most prevalent a stark blue that must have been inspired by Mary's blue robes. From the third floor, I hear Cristoforo calling Ed, then he calls me. He sounds urgent, excited. He and Ricardo talk at once in Polish and point to the middle of the dining room wall. We see an arch, then he rubs his wet cloth around it and scumbles of blue appear. Then a farmhouse, almond green, feathery strokes of what may be a tree. They have uncovered a fresco. We grab buckets and sponges and start gently cleaning the walls. Every swipe reveals more. Two people by a shore, water, distant hills. The biscuit-colored houses are the same colors we see all around us. Vibrant when wet, the colors pale as they dry. An electrical line buried at some point in the wall. Mars, a faux-framed classical scene of ruins in a panel over the door. We rub all afternoon. The lake scene continues on the adjoining wall, and it is vaguely familiar, like the villages and landscape around Lake Trasimeno. The naive style reveals no newly discovered Giotto, but it's charming. Someone didn't think so and whitewashed it. Luckily, they didn't use tougher paint. We will be able to live with this soft painting surrounding our dinners indoors. Restoration. I like the word. The house, the land, perhaps ourselves. But restored to what? Our lives are full. It's our zeal for all this work that amazes me. Is it only that once into the project, what it all means doesn't come up? Or that excitement and belief reject questions? The vast wheel has a place for our shoulders, and we simply push into the turning? I remember dreaming over Bachelard's The Poetics of Space, which I don't have with me, only a few sentences copied into a notebook. He wrote about the house as a tool for analysis of the human soul. By remembering rooms and houses we've lived in, we learn to abide, nice word, within ourselves. I felt close to his sense of the house. He wrote about the strange whir of the sun as it comes into a room in which one is alone. Mainly I remember recognizing his idea that the house protects the dreamer. The houses that are important to us are the ones that allow us to dream in peace. Guests we've had stop in for a night or two all come down the first morning ready to tell their dreams. Often the dreams are way back, father or mother dreams. I was in this car and my father was driving, only I was the age I am now, and my father died when I was 12. He was driving fast. Our guests fall into long sleeps, just as we do when we arrive each time. This is the only place in the world I've ever taken a nap at 9 in the morning. Could this be what Bachelard meant by the repose derived from all deep, oniric experience? After a week or so, I have the energy of a 12-year-old. For me, house, set in its landscape, always has been crypto primo image land. Bachelard pushed me to realize that the houses we experience deeply take us back to the first house. In my mind, however, it's not just to the first house, but to the first concept of self. Southerners have a gene, as yet undetected in the DNA spirals, that causes them to believe that place is fate. Where you are is who you are. The further inside you the place moves, the more your identity is intertwined with it. Never casual, the choice of place is the choice of something you crave. An early memory. Mine is a small room with six windows, all open on a summer night. I'm 3 or 4, awake after everyone has gone to bed. I'm leaning on the windowsill looking out at the blue hydrangeas, big as beach balls. The attic fan pulls in the scent of tea olive and lifts the thin white curtains. I'm playing with the screen latch, which suddenly comes undone. I remember the feel of the metal hook and the eye I almost can stick my little finger into. Next, I'm climbing up on the sill and jumping out the window. I find myself in the dark backyard. I start running, feeling a quick rush of what I now know as freedom. Wet grass, glow of white camellias on the black bush. The new pine, just my height. I go out to my swing in the pecan tree. I've just learned to pump. How high? I run around the house, all the rooms of my sleeping family. Then I stand in the middle of the street I am not allowed to cross. I let myself in the back door, which never was locked, and into my room. That pure surge of pleasure, flash flood of joy, to find the electric jolt of the outside place that corresponds to the inside, that's it. At home, I dream of former houses I've lived in, of finding rooms I didn't know were there. Many friends have told me that they, too, have this dream. I climb the stairs to the attic of the 18th-century house I loved living in for 3 years in Somers, New York. And there are 3 new rooms. In one, I find a dormant geranium, which I take downstairs and water. Immediately, Disney-style, it leafs and breaks into wild bloom. In house after house, my best friend's house in high school, my childhood home, my father's childhood home, I open a door, and there is more than I knew. All the lights are on in the New York house. I'm walking by, seeing the life in every window. I never dream of the boxy apartment I lived in at Princeton, nor do I dream of my flat I am so fond of in San Francisco. But perhaps that is because I can hear from my bed before I fall asleep, foghorns out on the bay. Those deep voices, displaced dreams, calling from spirit to spirit to some underlying voice we all have but don't know how to use. Here I am also restored to the basic pleasure of connection to the outdoors. The windows are open to butterflies, horseflies, bees, or anything that wants to come in one window and out another. We eat outside almost every meal. I'm restored to my mother's sense of preserving the seasons and to time, even time to take pleasure in polishing a pane of glass to a shine, to the house safe for dreaming. One end of the house is built right against the hillside, an omen of reconnection. Here I don't dream of houses. Here I am free to dream of rivers. Though the days are long, the summer is somehow short. My daughter Ashley arrives, and we have mad hot days driving around to sights. When she first walked up to the house, she stopped and looked up for a while, then said, "How strange! This will become a part of all our memories." I recognize that knowledge we sometimes get in advance when traveling or moving to a new city. Here's a place that will have its way with me. Naturally, I want her to love it, but I don't have to convince her. She begins talking about Christmas here. She chooses her room. "Do you have a pasta machine?" she asks. "Can we have melon every meal?" "A swimming pool could go up on that second terrace. Where's the train scheduled to Florence? I need shoes." The minute she graduated from college, she lit out for New York. The artist's life, the odd job life, the long hot summer, health problems. She's ready for the icy, mountain-fed pool run by a priest back in the hills, for trips to the Tyrrhenian coast, where we rent beach chairs and bake all day, for strolls in stony hill towns at night, after dinner in a strictly local trattoria. The days stream by, and soon it is time for both of us to leave. I must be at work, but Ed will stay another 10 days. Maybe the sandblaster will come. Festina tarde, make haste slowly. Walking out of the San Francisco airport, and shocked by cool, foggy air, smelling of salt and jet fumes. A taxi driver crosses the street to help with luggage. After a few pleasantries, we lapse into silence, and I'm grateful. I have been traveling for 24 hours. The houses on the hills are necklaces of light. Then along the right, the bay almost laps the freeway. I watch for a certain curve coming up. After rounding it, suddenly the whole city rises, the stark white skyline. As we drive in, I anticipate the breath-stopping plunges over hills and glimpses between buildings where I know there's a wedge or slice or expanse of rough blue water. Still, imprinted on my eyes are the stone towns, mown fields, and sweeping hills covered with vineyards, olives, sunflowers. We pass Victorian houses, discreetly shuttered and curtained, porch lights shining on wooden banisters and pots of topiary. No one, not even a dog walker or someone running to the store for milk, is out. I feel a pang for the towns full of people who leave their keys dangling in their locks, for the evening passeggiata when everyone is out and about, visiting, shopping, taking a quick espresso. I've left Ed there because his university starts later than mine, and the sandblasting still is a dream of accomplishment for the summer. The last of 11 messages on the machine starts with static. Then I hear Ed's voice. He sounds raspy. I was hoping to catch you, sweetheart. Are you still at work? The sandblaster was here when I got home from the airport. Long pause. It's hard to describe. The noise is deafening. He's got this huge generator, and the sand really does blast out and fall into every crack. It's like a storm in the Sahara. You can't believe how much sand is on the floors. It's in my ears, and I'm not even in the room with him. Sweeping is out of the question. I wish you were here. When he calls next, he's on the autostrada near Florence, en route to Nice and home. He sounds exhausted and elated. The permits have come through. The blasting is over. Primo Bianchi, however, won't be able to do our work because he must have a stomach operation. Ed met with Benito, a yellow-eyed Mussolini look-alike, and has worked out a contract with him. Work is to finish in early November, easily in time for Christmas. The cleanup goes slowly. The sandblaster says to expect sand to trickle down for 5 years. Ian, who helped us with the purchase, will oversee the work. We left diagrams of where electrical outlet switches and radiators should go, how the bathroom should be laid out, how the kitchen should be installed, even the height of the sink and the distance between the sink and the faucet, where to pick up the fixtures and tiles we selected for the bathroom, everything we can think of. We are anxious for word that work is underway. The first fax to us in San Francisco arrives September the 15th. Benito has broken his leg on the first day of the job, and startup will be delayed until he is able to walk. Festina tarda was a Renaissance concept, make haste slowly. Often it was represented by a snake with its tail in its mouth, by a dolphin entwined with an anchor, or by the figure of a seated woman holding wings in one hand and a tortoise in the other. The Great Wall of Bramasole in one, the central heating, kitchen, patio, and bathroom in the other. The second fax, October 12th, warns that delays have occurred, and that some changes in installation can be expected, but he has full confidence and not to worry. We fax back our encouragement and ask that everything be covered well with plastic and taped. Another fax just after says the opening of the 3-foot-thick wall between the kitchen and dining room has begun. 2 days later, Ian faxes us with the news that when a very large boulder was pulled out, the whole house creaked and all the workers ran out because they feared a collapse. We called. Didn't they brace the rooms? Hadn't Benito used steel? Why hadn't they known what to do? How could this happen? Ian said stone houses were unpredictable and couldn't be expected to react the way American houses react, and that the door is now in and looks fine, although they didn't make it as wide as we wanted because they were afraid to. I vacillated between thinking that the workers were incompetent and fearing that they might have been crushed by an unstable house. By mid-November, Benito has finished the upstairs patio and the opening of